Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. I finished the last show looking at alternative paper currencies in the United States. More than 30 local paper currencies are available in North America. One that has been particularly successful is the Ithaca Hour, H-O-U-R, originated by Paul Glover in Ithaca, New York. The hour is paper script that reads on the back, quote, "This is money. This note entitles the bearer to receive 1 hour of labor or its negotiated value in goods and services. Please accept it, then spend it." Ithaca Hours stimulate local business by recycling our wealth locally, and they help fund new job creation. Ithaca Hours are backed by real capital, our skills, our muscles, our tools, forests, fields, and rivers. End quote. One Ithaca Hour is considered to be the equivalent of $10, the average hourly wage in the area. More highly skilled services are negotiated in multiples of hours. A directory is published every couple of months that lists the goods and services people in the community are willing to trade for hours, and there is an hour bank. People can use hours to pay rent, shop at the farmer's market, or buy furniture. The local hospital accepts them for medical care. Several million Ithaca hours worth of transactions have occurred since 1991. A hometown money starter kit is available for $25 or 2.5 hours from Ithaca Money. So this program has been successful. Another successful credit program was originated by Edgar Kahn, a professor of law at the University of the District of Columbia, to help deal with inadequate government social programs. Like Glover, Kahn set out to create a new kind of money that was independent of both government and banks, one that could be created by people themselves. The unit of exchange in his system, called a time dollar, parallels the Ithaca dollar in being valued in man hours. In a landmark ruling, the Internal Revenue Service held that Kahn's service plan was not barter in the commercial sense and was therefore tax exempt. The ruling helped the program to spread quickly around the country. Kahn notes that social as well as economic benefits have resulted from this sort of program. Quote, "The very process of earning credits knits groups together. They begin having potluck lunches, and they begin forming neighborhood crime watch things, and they begin looking after each other and checking in, and they begin to set up food bank co-ops. The process seems to act as a catalyst for the creation of group cohesion in a society where that kind of catalyst is difficult to find." End quote. Local script has also been used to tide farmers over until harvest. Berkshire Farm Preserve notes were printed by a farmer when a bank in rural Massachusetts refused to lend him the money he needed to make it through the winter. Customers would buy the notes for $9 in the winter and could redeem them for $10 worth of vegetables in the summer. With small family farms rapidly disappearing, local currencies of this type are a way for the community to help farm families that have been abandoned by the centralized monetary system. Private currencies provide the tools to bind communities together, support local food growers, and maintain food supplies. Bernard Lietar, author of The Future of Money, describes other private currency innovations, including a system devised in Japan for providing for elderly care that isn't covered by national health insurance. People help out the elderly in return for caring relationship tickets that are put into a savings account. They can then be used when the account holder becomes disabled or can be sent electronically to elderly relatives living far away where someone else will administer care in return for credits. Another interesting model is found in Bali, where communities have a dual money system. Besides the national currency, the Balinese use a local currency in which the unit of account is a block of time of about 3 hours. The local currency is used when the community launches a local project, such as putting on a festival or building a school. The villagers don't have to compete with the outside world to generate this currency, which can be used to accomplish things for which they would not otherwise have had the funds. Another innovation that has served to expand the medium of exchange is the development of the corporate credits, such as airline frequent flyer miles, which can now be earned and spent in a variety of ways besides simply flying on the issuing airline. In some places, frequent flyer miles can be spent for groceries, telephone calls, taxis, restaurants, and hotels. The ATAR proposes extending this model to local governments to achieve community ends without the need to tax or vote special appropriations. For example, a system of carbon credits could reward consumers for taking measures that reduce carbon emissions. The credits would be accepted as a partial payment for other purchases that serve to reduce carbon emissions, producing a snowball effect, and businesses accepting the credits could use them to pay local taxes. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Alternative currency systems got a major boost with the advent of computers. No longer must private coins be minted or private bills be printed. Trades can now be done electronically. The first electronic currency system was devised after IBM released its XT computer to the public in 1981. Canadian computer expert Michael Linton built an accounting database, and in 1982 he introduced the local exchange trading system, LETS, a computerized system for recording transactions and keeping accounts. Like Cotton Mather, more than two centuries earlier, Linton had redefined money. In his scheme, it was merely an informative system for recording human effort. A LETS credit comes into existence when a member borrows the community's credit to purchase goods or services. The credit is extinguished when the member gives goods or services back to the community in satisfaction of his obligation to repay the credits. The exchange operates without any form of banking or reserves. Like the tally system of medieval England, it is just an accounting scheme tallying credits in and debits out. LETS credits cannot become scarce any more than inches can become scarce. They are tax-free and interest-free. They can be stored on a computer without even printing a paper copy. They are simply information. There are now at least 800 local exchange trading systems, LETS, in Europe, New Zealand, and Australia. They are less popular in the United States, but community currency advocate Tom Greco feels they will become more popular as conventional economies continue to decline and more people become marginalized. In a website called Travel Without Money, Australian enthusiast James Torres tells of his personal experiences with the LETS system. At a time when he had to quit his job and was watching his money carefully, he attended a LETS group meeting in his local community where he learned he could obtain a variety of services just for contributing an equivalent amount of his time. The result was the first and best professional massage he had ever had, a luxury for which he could not justify paying $60 cash when he was gainfully employed. He paid for this and other services by learning various internet and desktop publishing skills and contributing those skills to the group, something he quite enjoyed. He has been demonstrating the potential of the system by traveling around the world with very little conventional money. Friendly Favors is a LETS type computerized exchange system that has grown beyond the local community into a worldwide database of over 50,000 participants. The system tracks the exchange of thank yous, a unit of measure considered to be the equivalent of $1 saved due to friendly discount or favor received. The database also stores the photos, resumes, talents, interests, and community-building skills of participants. Developed by Sergio Lubb and Victor Gray of Walnut Creek, California, www.favors.org is a non-commercial service to interconnect those envisioning a world that works for all. Unlike most LETS systems, which have evolved among people short of money looking for alternative ways to trade, the Friendly Favors membership includes people who are financially well off and highly credentialed, who are particularly interested in the human resources potential of the system. Participants are spread over more than 189 countries, and the database is shared by hundreds of groups, making it potentially the largest source of human resources available on the internet. A number of good internet sites are devoted to the community currency concept, including IthacaHours.com, MadisonHours.org, and the site of CommunityCurrency.org. For a good general discussion of alternative money proposals, see Tom Greco's Monetary Education Project at ReinventingMoney.com. The definitive source for LETS information is Landsman's Community Services, LTD, in British Columbia, Canada. What are some of the limitations, though, of local currency systems? Local exchange systems demonstrate that money need not be something that is scarce or for which people have to compete. Money is simply credit. As Benjamin Franklin observed, Credit turns prosperity tomorrow into ready money today. Credit can be without gold, banks, governments, or even printing presses. It can all be done on a computer. The concept is good, but there are some practical limitations to the LETS model and other community currency systems as currently practiced. One is that the usual incentives for repayment are lacking, interest is not charged, and there may be no time limit for repayment. If you have ever lent money to a relative, you know the problem. Debts can go unpaid indefinitely. You can lean on your relatives because you know where to find them. But in the anonymity of a city or a nation, borrowers on the honor system can just disappear into the night. Some alternatives for keeping community members honest have been suggested by Tom Greco, who writes, quote, "There is always the possibility that a participant may choose to not honor his or her commitment, opting out of the system and refusing to deliver value equivalent to that received. There are three possible ways, which occur to me, of handling that risk. The first possibility is to use a funded exchange in which each participant surrenders or pledges particular assets as security against his or her commitment. A second possibility is to maintain an insurance pool funded by fees levied on all transactions to cover any possible losses. A third possibility is reliance upon group co-responsibility. That is, having each participant within an affinity group bear responsibility for the debts of others." Close quote. Those are possibilities, but they are not so practical or efficient as the contractual agreements used today, with interest charges and late penalties enforceable in court. Contracts to repay can be legally enforced by foreclosing on collateral, garnishing wages, and applying other remedies for breach of contract with or without interest provisions. But interest penalties make borrowers more inclined to be prudent in their borrowing and to pay their debts promptly. Eliminating interest from the money system would eliminate the incentive for private lenders to lend and would encourage speculation. If credit were made available without time limits or interest charges, people might simply borrow all the free money they could get, then compete to purchase bonds, stocks, or other income-producing assets with it, generating speculative asset bubbles. Imposing a significant cost on borrowing deters this sort of rampant speculation. In Muslim communities, interest is avoided because usury is forbidden in the Quran. To avoid infringing religious law, Islamic lawyers have gone to great lengths to design contracts that avoid interest charges. The most common alternative is a contract in which the banker buys the property and sells it to the client at a higher price to be paid in installments over time. The effect, however, is the same as charging interest. More money is owed back if the sum is paid over time than if it had been paid immediately. In large Western metropolises, where mobility is high and religion is not a pervasive factor, interest is considered a reasonable charge, acknowledging the time value of money. The objection of Greco and others to charging interest turns on the impossible contract problem, the problem of finding principal and interest to pay back loans in a monetary scheme in which only the principal is put into the money supply. But that problem can be resolved in other ways. A proposal for retaining the benefits of the interest system while avoiding the impossible contract problem is explored later in the show. A proposal for interest-free lending that might work is also described in future shows. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. A more serious limitation of private supplemental currencies is that they fail to deal with the mammoth debt spider that is sucking the lifeblood from the national economy. Supplemental currencies all assume a national currency that is being supplemented. Taxes must still be paid in the national currency, and so must bills for telephone service, energy, gasoline, and anything else that isn't made by someone in the local currency group. That means community members must still belong to the national monetary system. As Stephen Zerlenga observes in The Lost Science of Money, quote, such local currencies do not stop the continued mismanagement of the money system at the national level. They can't stop the continued dispensation of monetary injustice from above through the privately owned and controlled Federal Reserve money system. Ending that injustice should be our monetary priority. End quote. The national money problem can be solved only by reforming national currency. And that brings us back to the money question of the 1890s, greenbacks or gold? So let's start looking at that concept, the money question, gold bugs and greenbackers debate. As William Jennings Bryan said in the 1896 Democratic Convention, you shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold. At opposite ends of the debate over the money question in the 1890s were the gold bugs, led by the bankers, and the greenbackers, who were chiefly farmers and laborers. The use of the term gold bug has been traced to the 1896 presidential election, when supporters of gold money took to wearing lapel pins of small insects to show their position. The greenbackers, on the other extreme, were suspicious of a money system dependent on the bankers' gold, having felt its crushing effects in their own lives. As Vernon Parrington summarized their position in the 1920s, quote, to allow the bankers to erect a monetary system on gold is to subject the producer to the money broker and measure deferred payments by a yardstick that lengthens or shortens from year to year. The only safe and rational currency is a national currency based on the national credit, sponsored by the state, flexible, and controlled in the interests of the people as a whole. End quote. The gold bugs countered that currency backed only by the national credit was too easily inflated by unscrupulous politicians. Gold, they insisted, was the only stable medium of exchange. They called it sound money, or honest money. Gold had the weight of history to recommend it, having been used as money for 5,000 years. It had to be extracted from the earth under difficult and often dangerous circumstances, and the earth had only so much of it to relinquish. The supply of it was therefore relatively fixed. The virtue of gold was that it was a rare commodity that could not be inflated by irresponsible governments out of all proportion to the supply of goods and services. The greenbackers responded that gold's scarcity, far from being a virtue, was actually its major drawback as a medium of exchange. Gold coins might be honest money, but their scarcity had led governments to condone dishonest money, the sleight of hand known as fractional reserve banking. Governments that were barred from creating their own paper money would just borrow it from banks that created it and then demanded it back with interest. As Stephen Zerlenga noted in The Lost Science of Money, quote, all of the plausible sounding gold standard theory could not change or hide the fact that, in order to function, the system had to mix paper credits with gold in domestic economies. Even after this addition, the mixed gold and credit standard could not properly service the growing economies. They periodically broke down with dire domestic and international results. In the worst such breakdown, the Great Crash and Depression of 1929 to 1933, it was widely noted that those countries did best that left the gold standard soonest. End quote. The reason gold has to be mixed with paper credits is evident from the math. As noted earlier, a dollar lent at 6% interest, compounded annually, becomes $10 in 40 years. That means that if the money supply were 100% gold, and if bankers lent out 10% of its 6% interest compounded annually, continually rolling over principal and interest into new loans, in 40 years, the bankers would own all the gold. To avoid that result, either the money supply needs to be able to expand, which means allowing fiat money, or interest needs to be banned, as it was in the Middle Ages. The debate between the gold bugs and the greenbackers still rages, but today the gold bugs are not the bankers. Rather, they are in the money reform camp along with the greenbackers. Both factions are opposed to the current banking system, but they disagree on how to fix it. This is one reason the modern money reform movement hasn't made much headway politically. As Machiavelli said in the 16th century, he who introduces a new order of things has all those who profit from the older order as his enemies, and he has only lukewarm allies in all those who might profit from the new. Maverick reformers continue to argue among themselves while the bankers and their hired economists march in lockstep, fortified by media they have purchased and laws they have gotten passed with the powerful leverage of their bank-created money. There's little debate that gold is an excellent investment, particularly in times of economic turmoil. When the Argentine peso collapsed, families with a stash of gold coins reported that one coin was sufficient to make it through a month on the barter system. Gold is a good thing to own, but the issue debated by money reformers is something else. Should it be the basis of the national currency, either alone or as backing for paper and electronic money? Gold bugs maintain that a gold currency is necessary to keep the value of money stable. Greenbackers agree on the need for stability, but question whether the price of gold is stable enough to act as such a peg. In the 19th century, farmers knew the problem firsthand, having seen their profits shrink as the gold price went up. A real-world model is hard to come by today, but one is furnished by the real investment market in Vietnam, where sales have recently been undertaken in gold. In the fall of 2005, the price of gold soared to over $500 an ounce. When buyers suddenly had to pay tens of millions more Vietnamese dong for a house valued at 100 taels of gold, the real estate market ground to a halt. The purpose of money is to tally the value of goods and services traded, facilitating commerce between buyers and sellers. If the yardstick by which value is tallied keeps stretching and shrinking itself, commerce is impaired. When gold was the medium of exchange historically, prices inflated along with the supply of gold. When gold from the New World flooded Spain in the 16th century, the country suffered massive inflation. During the California gold rush of the 1850s, consumer prices also shot up with the rising supply of gold. From 1917 to 1920, the U.S. gold supply surged again, as gold came pouring into the country in exchange for war materials. The money supply became seriously inflated and consumer prices doubled, although the money supply was supposedly being strictly regulated by the Federal Reserve. During the 1970s, the value of gold soared from $40 an ounce to $800 an ounce, dropping back to a low $255 in February of 2001. If friends had been paid in gold coins, they would have swung wildly as well. Again, people on fixed incomes generally prefer a currency that has a fixed and predictable value, even if it exists only as a number in their checkbooks. And I will continue in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.